Hey everyone, it's Adam. I just want to call out in advance that my mic quality in this episode is not very good, and I'm sorry for that. Hopefully, it's not too distracting. I just want you to know it's still early in our podcast, but I'm listening, I'm learning, and I will do better. On with the show. I guess we need to think of our like inflammatory question.
Yes. Maybe it doesn't even need to be a question. Maybe it needs to just be like just hot take.
Hot take. What are your hot takes on hot takes?
Don't. Too meta. What is, hey Adam,
Hey Dee.
what is your hot take on thought leadership?
Well, whatever it is, I'm going to tell you one line at a time with spaces in between.
Like, we're not just trying to be gatekeepy here because we've probably done some of the things that we may end up making fun of today. Like, I think what we're trying to get to is to figure out, does one need to thought lead to be relevant today? Does one have a thought to lead on? Does one need to lead if one has a thought? Like, I think these are all of the
Oh my God. My brain has exploded already. The reason why, we talk about this often is because there is so much pressure to be a thought leader, and people are told if they want to progress in their careers that they need to do this. And the validation loop that comes from posting on places like LinkedIn, where you can see how many impressions you got. Even then, the way you were phrasing it a moment ago, I think about that a lot. Like, because you put thought lead as the noun phrase. That's true. Like, we're asking people, and we're feeling pressure to do this thing called thought leadership and to like be a thought leader and to do thought leadership. When really, like, the reason why that phrase existed in the first place, presumably, was our business wanted to have the first, best, and brightest perspective on something because in our category, because otherwise we are not going to be seen as like owning the space, right? That's what the thoughts were supposed to be leading.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I just Googled it, or what are we saying now in the AI world? I just
Chatted with the GPT about it.
AI-gled it, and it was like the term thought leadership was coined by Joel Kurtzman in 1994. Obviously, knowing that the concept predated the coining of the term, but it was about individuals possessing unique insights about business consumers in the marketplace. Popularize ideas of individuals who influence others through their ideas and perspectives. So that's interesting.
Why I think it's interesting the way that we talk about thought leadership is if it's just like you have to be a thought leader, you have to like do thought leadership. And what we're not incentivizing, like we're incentivizing people sometimes, or like making people feel like they have to do the form of thought leadership. They have to do this like LinkedIn bro-etry instead of actually thinking about like what they have to say that is original and unique.
And I think that, like, even at the core of that is like thought leadership assumes expertise on the thought, and expertise comes from being a practitioner over and over again, honing the craft, failing, succeeding, and really like getting, having like skin in the game, having rolled up your sleeves and done the thing in order to earn the expertise that then I think should be the baseline for thought leadership. But I think our conversations often go in the place of like critiquing. I'm going to try to manipulate the algorithm without having been a practitioner in this space, without having that earned expertise. And I think that's where it becomes a problem. And then I think from that also, even people who have earned thought leadership are, you and I could also be victim to following these certain like tropes of thought leadership, or like maybe a format on LinkedIn or whatever that seems to get the clicks and the engagement that you're looking for. Because if you're thought leading in a forest and a tree falls, like, you know
Yeah,
what I mean?
if you, I know. I was waiting to see how you landed that plane. No, I get it. I get it though, because it's true. You can't thought lead into a void is the phrase that's coming to me. And I want to unpack some of the things that you just talked about, and we can also make sure to take a little pit stop in what you said there at the end, which is that we fall victim to the same things too, and we also, can be tempted by the exact same engagement traps. Like, I don't think either of us is purely above this. Certainly I'm not. But I think you and I have noticed the same thing, right? Where it's been often hijacked in some ways by people who are marketing to those practitioners in a field, right? We can take like customer success, for instance. There's people who have done customer success over and over and over, and they can share what they've been doing. And then there are people who are marketing to customer success professionals. Often they're sharing things that have the same form of thought leadership, but it's coming from people who haven't necessarily done it, or maybe they've done it for a very brief period of time at a low level. And so you're not really getting earned insights. You're getting like something that sounds interesting and provocative, but it isn't, it's not earned insight. So it's not good guidance. So you're gonna get something that kind of like sounds interesting, but you can't really take with you and implement and will necessarily be successful.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
And this is the reason why we started talking about this in the first place. Like when you're new to a field, it's really hard to tell the difference between those two things.
Mm.
There are people who are speaking from an actual place of experience, and there are people who are saying things that have the form of earned insights, but are actually just more like vague generalizations. And sometimes it's easy to tell because they take the form of hot takes.
Yeah.
But then sometimes even people who have been in the field, they'll still say things that have that same format. They'll be like, oh, customer success is dead. And here's why.
Yeah.
And like anyone can say customer success is dead. It's what you say after that that matters and that probably reveals like whether you've actually been doing that work or not.
Yeah. And do you know what? I have to blame. And I say this with like a lot of deep, deep, deep respect for some of the things that HubSpot does. But I kind of blame HubSpot for some of this because they are one of the leaders in harnessing the power of thought leadership and distribution. I think like we've all learned a lot from HubSpot mm-hmm. in this category. But I'm looking at like some of their articles online. I was like, right, this is where I learned this, right? It's like there's a lot of published content about becoming thought leaders someday. And I think it's like all rooted in like really good practice. Like that's not what I'm critiquing HubSpot on. It's like you need to know your stuff, like you need to teach, you can inspire mm-hmm. folks and do all of that kind of stuff. But I think that a lot of the like examples of thought leadership have been pretty varied over time. And because they're so grounded in some of the marketing hype cycle stuff, I think people kind of glommed onto it and started saying, okay, if this sells from a distribution perspective, it's fine. It's absolutely okay. And I think that's where I kind of, I think the credibility piece of it and building credibility as a marketing tactic is where I was like, okay, that's not it. Like marketing credibility to me is different from like earned credibility. There's a, like it veers off.
HubSpot has built their entire business on inbound marketing. And inbound marketing, like if you're going to learn how to be a great inbound marketer, it means you need to be able to produce a lot of content that will build your brand and your credibility. So that kind of starts with two things. One is you being able to produce a lot of content and to be able to get people to that content. But it also means that the content that you're producing has to do more than engage with concepts on a superficial level. You need to be able to address it in different ways. You need to be able to teach your audience something so that they'll go further down that. Well, they wouldn't say funnel, they would say flywheel, right? Because that's a big HubSpot thing as well, is that marketing is not a funnel, it's a flywheel. And that flywheel is powered by you saying interesting things that resonate with your audience and where you're teaching them something and they want to engage with you more and then they buy from you and then you learn from the customers that bought from you and then you say more interesting things and so on and so on, which in theory works really well. So I don't blame them for that. But what I think happens is that you see something out there that works. And once something works,
right,
then you start getting this kind of like second or third wave of people who want to take the tactics and they want to take the form of what works.
Right.
But the original ideas aren't there anymore. So you end up with folks who have this like hot take brain poisoning.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so they're not really like sharing interesting ideas anymore. They're just kind of chasing after what they think will convert and ultimately either build their personal brand or if they have something to sell, we'll bring in more leads.
Yeah. And it's kind of like it's kind of an example of like, this is why we can't have nice things, right? Because once something converts, then you throw all your budget behind that. You throw all your time, all of your creativity behind that thing that is working. And it was like, you know, these are the, like, I remember I was working at a consumer sort of like education company at the time. And that, and like, you had to convert, you're like, you had to optimize your pages to convert into a sale, right? From like an individual. And so we were like reading books like Traction. We did like everything HubSpot told us to do. And like, it worked. It actually worked. And what happens when you do that is like, you learn how to reverse engineer something that's working and replicate it a million times, right? Then you kind of go into the POC world where you're like replicating that experiment and you're like doing it over and over and over and over again. And when you mass produce something like that, when you do it to this level, it can't be earned, because the earned thing takes so much time, right? Expertise takes time to build. It's much easier to like understand, oh, this person had expertise, but there's plenty of experts that like aren't going viral. So when you do see an expert that does go viral, you actually end up giving more weight to the tactic that made them go viral and less to the earned expertise. And you replicate that, because that's
Yeah, you're taking the wrong form. That's such a good point. Like, often experts don't have time to be posting on LinkedIn or sharing all of their their expert thoughts. So like, disproportionately, when you see something resonate like that, you take away the wrong conclusion about why it resonated.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, and then you and I were having this conversation about before, because like, I had been doing a little bit of like being in the public eye, like over a decade ago, actually, because I worked at the same company that I like gave you the example of. I was like, you know, kind of like teaching online, and we did a lot of stuff on YouTube and all that kind of stuff. And I got burnt out on it. And I was like, I hate this, because like, it made me not like the work that I was doing. Right. It's like it's like the monetization of hobbies people talk about. Right. Like, don't do it, because you'll hate the thing that you used to formerly love. It was kind of like that. And so then I like left it for 10 years. So when we were talking about like doing something like this podcast or like writing together or whatever, I was like, I'm meh, I don't wanna. And like, we had many conversations as friends where you were like, no, you should, like, you're doing the work. It's different. And I was like, I don't know if I can like bridge that. And then we finally did this podcast, right? But that's, I think, like, to your point, like, I think that's the issue. The people that should be thought leading tend to not want to, right? And it's like,
Either because they don't have the time, or because it's like, what's reverse Dunning-Kruger?
Like, yeah, that's a
good point. Like, it's like the inverse of Dunning-Kruger, right? Like, the people who it's imposter syndrome, I guess. Like, the people who actually like have the expertise are like holding themselves to a higher standard, because they know whether what they have to say is like high quality or not. Whereas someone who's just kind of like taking the form of thought leadership doesn't really have much of a quality barrier. So they can say whatever, and then Dunning-Kruger kicks in.
Right.
And that, do we need to explain Dunning-Kruger?
Yes, do it.
Okay, so Dunning-Kruger is the Dunning-Kruger effect is basically like the phenomenon. I should ChatGPT this, but I'm going to be clickety-clacketing on the mic if I do that. It basically an experiment that they ran where they found that it was the people who often knew the least, or who had like the least expertise in a field, were most likely to overestimate their knowledge of the field. So it's like, it's really hard to like self-assess.
Yeah.
Like how much of a blind spot you have in your knowledge.
Yeah. I love that. And I AI-gled it. So
did you? Amazing. Okay.
I tried to softly type on my keyboard. A cognitive bias where individuals with low competence in a specific area overestimate their abilities, while highly competent individuals may underestimate their expertise.
Okay. So actually it's not even inverse. It's the same thing. It's still Dunning-Kruger.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it accounts for both, but I think it's interesting in how many ways this plays out as well. Like I'd had somebody like give me a job description. They wanted to like combine two teams, and it was clear that like they were underestimating one of the teams that like they had never run from a different department, and in the squishing of the two. Right. And so that's another way in which this manifests, is like, sometimes I think people, when you're trying to like reorg, or you're combining skills, or you're trying to figure out like topics that like mesh together, you think the other one makes more sense to combine into your world, and it'll become more fluid and it'll be easy to do it. But it's actually this whole thing that like, it's the tip of the iceberg, right? So there's so many ways in which I've like,
out. I mean, I've felt that hard in my own career. You know, when you were talking about your kind of your own journey, getting comfortable with being more vocal and possibly being a thought leader. But first, I guess I want to talk about my own Dunning-Krugerdom in that sense, because, you know, I grew up in the world of customer education, and over time I have been thrust into situations where now all of a sudden I'm owning something or heavily collaborating with someone where it's not something that's customer education, right? That's how I got into community. That's how I got into documentation. That's now how I'm getting more into digital customer success and customer experience. And the first time I was exposed to any of those concepts, I was looking at them through the lens of the thing I already knew. And so I was underestimating the level of complexity of, like, what does it take to really run a community? It's not just do the same things you did in customer education and some other related stuff. Digital, like, you even called me out on this as I've been kind of getting more into the digital world. Like, I was at first underestimating and thinking of, how is it different from some of the customer comms work that I've done in the past? Well, no, actually it is different. Like, there's different triggers, different outcomes to look at, et cetera, et cetera. And, like, the more you go, 10 years ago in my career, I would have been rushing out there to say, hey, I'm doing all of this digital work now, and let me tell you the cool framework that I just thought up about how digital customer success and customer education connect to each other. That's a pressure that I've felt in my career. Because you brought this up earlier, and I want to kind of, like, draw this in, because we've been talking about thought leadership as a thing originally that marketing departments have done for their businesses.
Yeah.
It's certainly true, like, and I don't mean this in any bad way. Like, I think marketers often have a bit of the Dunning-Kruger because they're looking at the fields to which they're marketing through the lens of someone who is speaking to the practitioners, but often they're not the practitioners themselves. So it's just impossible to know all of the nuance out there. So you can kind of spend your time as a marketer listening really deeply and trying to reflect what people in the field are saying and trying to get people in the field to talk and also probably say nice things about your company in the process. Or you can, like, try to come up with these, like, big revelatory frameworks. And at some point, that whole dynamic, and you were talking about HubSpot. I think, like, maybe this is where, like, Gary Vee came in and yeah, also started, like, getting in the mix.
100%.
Yeah, that, like, this whole dynamic that we're talking about companies and marketing departments do, now all of a sudden became personal.
Yeah.
Like, you personally have to be a thought leader. You personally have to market yourself. You have to be saying these interesting things. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to stand out in a competitive market of personal brands. And that makes you feel like you have to say all of these, like, interesting revelatory things and come up with all of these cool frameworks.
Right.
But that takes you further away from actually, like, spending the time to listen, learn, cultivate competence, get good at what you were doing. And so that's something that, like, I felt through my career, is this, like, getting less and less comfortable just, like, saying things that sound really intelligent about a field, because, like, that seems less valuable now.
That's so fascinating. I mean, like, 100%. So first of all, like, yes, Gary Vee actually, like, originally, it would probably have been, some of this was in the, like, 4-hour work week guys, like, various writing.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Why can't I think
what's
of
that guy's name? Eric?
Tim? Is it? Why don't I know his name?
Tim. Yes. Tim Ferriss.
Okay. Tim Ferriss. Yes. It was, like, that kind of whole era where I think we were just probably entering the workforce at this time. It was, like, early aughts, right? It's like Gary Vee. Mm-hmm. Late odds, like Gary Vee, Tim Ferriss,
early V. It was the year 5 in Roman numerals.
Yeah, and, like, Marie Forleo and, like, all of those people were, like, in the space of creating content that was very much focused on their personalities. There's some, like, probably earned expertise in there, but a lot of it I remember was almost, like, grifty, if I'm honest. And so I remember, like, thinking, okay, there are tactics here that work. How do we, like, bring this into where we are in academia at the time, or, like, we are in education? How do we, like, actually use this to get our stuff out there because we're trying to, like, help? So then I had this, like, really weird relationship with the concept of, like, what help means as well, because, like, it's in the eye of the receiver, right? Like, so if someone is getting a lot from the Gary V's and the whatever, like, who am I to say? So I think there's, like, a lot of that piece as well. And so I appreciate what you're saying, because it is much more in line with, like, the part of thought leadership that I think we're trying to discuss, which is, like, professionals who are not millionaire content creators like the Tims and Maries and, you know, like Gary's, but it's people like us who are working for money and paycheck and like also are potentially helping the brands of other companies if we become thought leaders and are like sponsored or whatever. Like there's a lot of those folks out on LinkedIn. So I appreciate you grounding the discussion in that, as well as the difficulty of the concept of thought leadership in that. Cause what we're not discussing is like the like super personality cult people that are like millionaires based on products that they sell.
That's a playbook that people can sell, right? Like, oh, you can monetize yourself by, you know, finding this like one niche where you have something to say and you can build your course and you can charge people for the course and you can be, like, we saw all of this blow up in the world yep. of education and community, especially over COVID, where everyone was like selling this dream of you as a solopreneur can go build yep. your business with like your own courses. You can build a community around yourself, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You are the product.
Right.
And so when you said a moment, I want to ask you more about this, because you're like, I don't judge anyone if they like well, if I they do. Learn something from Gary V or what they took away from that. Like, yeah, it seems an awful lot to me. Like there's an ethical thing that you can learn, like yeah. that is legitimate ways to market yourself that will work. But then there's like a line of where there's like unethical dark patterns that you can use to make yourself seem like a thought leader when you're not. And yeah. I worry sometimes that like, even again, just like reflecting on myself in my early career, like I don't know that I spent a lot of time or had like a great way to differentiate like what are the type of things that like ethically I should be talking about versus like when am I like way outside my depth? And mm-hmm. I think it's probably gotten worse. So like, I'm curious when you were talking about that whole thing about like what you take away from these like Gary V types.
There is a sort of thought leader that I really, really like and gravitate towards. Now that mm-hmm. is much of a quieter personality that like, but that thought leads a lot. What's
like they actually are leading with their thoughts.
Yeah. 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 And it's like incredibly earned. And there's something also nostalgic about this. So like when I think I've been inundated by thought leaders, like the ones that we just described, where it's a bit too much flash and, you know, whiz, boom, bang. And then the kernel of like insight is like buried. You know, it's like a 30-second clip maybe within a like 45-minute YouTube video or like millions of downloads of stolen emails and things like that before I can get like one tiny bit of insight from
yeah.
you know, that's like not what I'm interested in. The thought leader, like I'll give you an example. Somebody that I recently discovered that I think is doing like awesome content is one of the founders of Intercom, Des Trainer, like has this kind of like 90s blog and like speaks and his stuff is like on the internet. And it's like very old school kind of, I mean, it's new school. It's all like on, you know, modern yeah. technology, but the style of like thought leadership is kind of that old school way of like leading. You know, it's like, I used to have a boss when I worked in public media that was like this. His name was Jim. He was like an old school engineer. He was like a ham radio guy. He used to like climb these big towers and like fix ham radios and talk to me about like the Clue Train manifesto and stuff like that. And it's like these, you know, like these guys that are very, very into technology from and always have been. And they're thinking about them in different ways. And they're like very genuine in the way that they talk about it. Right. And like,
yeah.
not trying to have hot takes. They're talking about when I was building this thing, it's very earned is what I'm saying. But there's also something less filtered and less polished about their approach to thought leading that maybe it feels authentic. And to me is like, is slightly academic without the douchebaggery of academia, if that makes sense, right? It's like somebody who like knows what yeah. they have been a practitioner in this space for a long time. So they're just talking at a level where you're like, oh, I have to like rewind this part and like take notes or like think about this more deeply, where it's like just coming off, you know, the tongue for them. There's something.
Yeah. There. Like some, I agree. And I think sometimes it's that like the ideas are at the forefront. Like they're not yeah. trying to center themselves and their personalities. They're trying to center the ideas, and you can tell like it bleeds through whether someone is yeah. genuinely interested in something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like, I'm trying to think of some good, even having worked at Slack, like I felt like Stuart Butterfield was often this way where he was a philosopher at heart, even though he was also, you know, a philosopher wearing a businessman hat and suit.
Yeah.
But like, the way that he would talk about the space, like he had wholly original ideas
yeah.
and you felt like often he was trying to translate those into something that would work in a business context. And I always really appreciated that, because I think that originality, that was thought leadership. He was bringing something different to the sphere in which we all worked versus kind of regurgitating hot takes. Like,
yeah,
he wasn't saying email is dead and here's what's here to replace it.
Yeah, exactly. That's an interesting thing that you just said too, that because that's something that I recoil. You've also mentioned that this is not your favorite thing, where it's the fear-mongering style of thought leadership. So that's like one of the tropes that is just like, no, like when someone's like, this is dead. Or, and we're hearing it with AI all the time now, right? It's like everyone's behind.
Yeah.
Even the people, like even Sam Altman's behind by the standards that some of the people are like setting right now around AI. And it's like, that's not thought leadership.
Yeah.
Really, it's not really.
FOMO, it doesn't feel like thought leadership. It feels, I mean, it feels like content marketing, but it doesn't feel like thought leadership in the sense that like FOMO is just, I don't know, it's easy. It's easy to like get people to buy something from you when they're scared. So again, it doesn't feel like they're centering an authentic idea. It sort of makes it feel like they're trying to attract attention to themselves or their product. I think another one I don't super love is when people kind of take a content product first approach.
Mm.
You hear from them often and they're like coming up with new, like, here's my ebook about this. Here's my report that I'm making, but like, it's not high quality.
Mm.
So you feel like the first idea was like, let me make content about this versus this is an idea that I authentically want to explore and like say something new about. Or
yeah. This is that like reverse engineering of like HubSpot that I feel like went awry, right? Because like in an ideal
world, yeah, I kind of talked about that.
And you want to say it, but if you're like, I want to be popular, or I want this thing to get this much engagement, and you reverse engineer it, like that's, I think it's like almost a tell now.
Yeah. The other one that I'm thinking about, overly frameworkizing things. And that's not really a word, but
tell me about this.
Well, because this is what got me thinking about this in the first place. Because often, okay, when you're earlier in your career, or like, let me even speak from a personal place. Like when I was earlier in my career, like I freaking loved frameworks. And this is also because like I have consultant brain, you know, like if you put something in a 2x2 matrix, I am good to go. It feels revelatory. If you put something in a maturity model, like it makes more sense. And I get that. I get that, like, conceptually, it is actually helpful to find ways to take experience and back it into some sort of concept or framework, or sometimes like a pithy phrase. Like you and I use all sorts of phrases and concepts as shorthand for other things. We talked about Dunning-Kruger earlier today. We say things like, don't let perfect be the enemy of good, or like,
there's a million. We do rattle them off.
There's a million, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, right. And, but like, that's shorthand for a bunch of deeper ideas and often a bunch of experiences that we could pattern match against.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is like earlier in my career, I was underestimating, I think, the value of the experiences and overestimating the value of the framework or the pithy phrase or the maturity model.
Yeah.
And so if I wanted to write a LinkedIn post, or I think at the time they weren't even posts, they were like, you have to write like separate articles on LinkedIn and like link to them from the feed. Or like if I was like going to a conference and I like was applying to give a conference talk or something like that, I always thought like the big deal was trying to find like the big framework and the concept. And I was like, if I could like put something in a concept that sounds flashy and makes sense, like that's what's going to get me into these conferences. That's what's going to get me into the big leagues. Maybe it did. I don't know. But like the older I get and the more like we go through these cycles, like if I'm seeing someone who's earlier in their career doing that, like I almost want to just say to them, you can do that. That's fine. But actually, like, just know that for like those of us who are watching you speak or listening to your ideas, it's actually your earned insights. It's your real experiences. It's the things that you've actually done and learned that are like very tactical and probably seem dreadfully boring to you.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're embarrassed to talk about them a little bit because they're a little bit cringe and you haven't gotten them perfect and you're still having all of these issues with them behind the scenes. That's actually the interesting stuff.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And it's funny, right? Because like I I think we did it ourselves when we were younger because we felt like we didn't have enough earned insights. And so let's couple what we do have some experience with like a framework, you know, like, and that'll bring some credibility and some gravitas to like what we're saying. But I wish I could go back to myself and say, you know, like 20 years ago and say the expertise that you need to bring is your own expertise. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be like 20 years D from now and bring all of that experience, because 20 years D is going to bring that experience somewhere else in this conference or, you know, like in this talk or in the field. Like, it kind of reminds me, just to like go to a completely different field for a second. But in fashion, there's this like, you know, when the big blogger movement was like heavy in the same time frame that we're talking about with the like Tim Ferriss's and like Gary Vee's and Marie Forleo's, et cetera, like style bloggers were making a ton of money online, right? And these are like people, there are some that we went to UT with that became huge, like millionaires from like style blogging online. And one of the ones, as the like style blogger sort of cohort like aged and became like, you know, in their 30s and had a lot more disposable income and were like going, you know, to like all these expensive brands, there's like style rookie Tavi Gevinson was like a very young, I think like in high school, blogger that became absolutely massive. And she wasn't trying to be like a Vogue editor level like producer of fashion content, but she was speaking in an incredibly educated, very like intelligent way about fashion from her vantage point as a teenager. And it was some of the best stuff that like you could read at the time, right? And like she was in the same peer group as like people who had like decades more of earned insight and like professional experience than her. But her voice was in the upper echelon. And it's because it was so different and so specific to like where she was holding strength from, which is exactly where she went.
I'm so glad you said earned insight again, because we've been talking about earned insight this whole time as the thing that kind of differentiates. If you want to do thought leadership, and by the way, I would say you don't have to. Like, anyone who's giving you FOMO about you have to do thought leadership, you have to like be on the LinkedIns, otherwise you're not going to progress in your career. No, it helps if you do it right, but it's not, I don't think it's the most important thing in the world. But I'm glad you mentioned earned insight again, because like, even if you're young, even if you're earlier in your career, you do have earned insight.
Right.
You do have a genuine experience from being early career in whatever field that you're in. You are learning things, like you are trying things in your company.
Yeah.
And you can talk about that. Like I like when people talk about that, because it still feels original, because it's someone's original experience that like I haven't had.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's a great thing to anchor on. Like I'll tell you, there's one time that I ended up doing this was at a South by Southwest panel that I had submitted, and I was like 27 or 8 or something like that. And me and my friend Adam, other Adam, I do have other friends named Adam. I'm so sorry, Adam.
That's okay. You know what? I'm not offended. I'm just going to go ahead and quietly change my name.
I know you have to now. So yeah, my friend Adam and I were like, okay, let's do this panel on how public radio is just like full of baby boomers and none of us like young upstarts can like get any of our ideas through and like do anything. So we ended up doing this like South by Southwest panel. Called Big Old Babies, Why Boomers Equal Public Radio Fail, or something like that. I have to like Google it. It was like me and Adam, same age. And then we had two veteran, like president of some of the biggest stations and like public radio entities at all, like on the panel with us. And they were amazing. And like, I still kind of follow their careers today. They're like incredible, decades older than us, experienced people. And we sat there and we just talked about essentially like what was happening in public radio and like how we needed to create like much more investment in younger voices. And so like literally like this panel was sort of like a coming together of generations to say like, hey, you've got great expertise with your earned insight. It doesn't just mean that earned insight, like you're not a thought leader by virtue of like collecting insights over years and years and years and years. It's just about the insights that you've gathered from exactly where you are and the experience that you have had, because no one else is going to have that experience.
And I think that's a great point to be kind of coalescing around. Cause again, like you said it earlier and I agree, like we're not saying this to be gatekeepers, and we're not saying this because we think that like we're thought leaders and no one else can't be. Like, I actually cringe with the term thought leader because I don't like it, and I don't like identifying as it. To, like, because it to me, it, like, the term itself even feels a little like statusy, yeah. gatekeepy,
yeah,
whatever. But I think if I were to talk to my, you know, 10 years ago self and be like, hey, like, do you want to be a thought leader? Is that an interesting idea to you? Like, I think he would have said yes. Like, I would love that credibility. I would love to, like, be doing, you know, public speaking and sharing my ideas and all of that. And it's really hard to, like, connect with your motivations from back then, because, yeah. you know, memory is like a very imperfect thing. But I think today, at least, kind of settled on the idea that what I really want to do, I don't want to just, like, attract attention to myself. I want to share ideas and experiences that I think will be helpful.
Yeah.
Even though, like, don't get me wrong, I like attention. It's not the, I don't feel that same pressure to be like, oh, I have to, like, come up with these, like, really interesting seeming
yeah.
frameworks, maturity models, things like that. Like, actually speaking from my own experience and being vulnerable about, like, what works and what doesn't work is, I don't know, it just seems like the better path now.
Yeah, I think it's awesome. And for folks who are a little bit more on kind of maybe my side of it, where if I had been asked that question, I would have been like, hell no. And I think a lot of it comes from, like, mm-hmm. growing up as the daughter of, like, a teacher in the school that I was learning in. It's like everybody, yeah. like all the people knew who I was and were, like, watching me. And when I, like, tried my first cigarette in the back of a school, and I, like, by the time I came out from having tried that cigarette with my, like, little teenage friends, my mom already freaking knew. And I got across the street where she was teaching to, like, get my little lunchbox, you know, after, like, dousing myself in perfume so she couldn't smell me. And before I even walked in, she was like, so you tried a cigarette today? Yeah. Because, like, a teacher had told another teacher who had told my mom. Yeah. So I was like, man, I can't wait to get out of the small town that I live in and live in the biggest place in the world where I am just a number, which is why I chose UT, other than, of course, like, academic credentials. But at the time, it was the biggest university in the state. Yeah. But it's like, but I think that there's still something to doing stuff like this, because if you like your work and if you want to become better at it, this is also a form through which you do that, right? There's, like, reading a thing, yeah. applying a thing, and teaching a thing. And this is, to me, like, a part of that. And so, again, if it's, like, if it's practitioner based, then I tend to be more game. But some of the things that I struggle with are when it's, like, when it feels a little bit more like some of the BSE stuff that we've talked about earlier, where it's like, talk yeah. about these things, but the, like, actual kernel of wisdom is, like, buried in a whole bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
You have boxes to check or somebody to appease, that becomes really hard to do.
I agree. And the other thing that I would caution against, because I've fallen into this trap as well, is, like, the things that perform well on LinkedIn, for instance, or on your blog, or, you know, yeah. wherever it is that you're trying to, like, do thought leadership, like, those aren't necessarily the, I think I have to quote the TED tagline, those aren't ideas worth sharing always.
Yeah.
Like, I've definitely fallen into the trap of where, like, I've made some intentionally provocative posts before because I've seen, for instance, like, oh, I know if I do this type of, like, hot takey kind of post, like, I'm pretty sure this will perform. Or, oh, I notice when I talk about this topic, like, it'll perform well.
Yeah.
And I felt myself kind of getting, like, sucked into that whole vortex of, yeah. oh, do I need to perform for the algorithm, or yeah. do I need to focus on these types of things because they're going to play well? And I've had to walk myself back from that whole idea to be like, yeah. wait, what does it matter? What does it matter if it performs well? What do you gain
yeah.
if this post has, like, 10,000 impressions versus 20,000 impressions versus 5,000 impressions versus, like, 100 impressions? It doesn't, yeah. Yeah. impressions mean nothing to your actual, like, yeah. like, yeah, maybe more people saw you on their LinkedIn feed, but, like, is that the way to build a fulfilling career? Are those ideas yeah. that are worth sharing? No. So, like,
yeah.
like, don't get too fixated on that.
I like that. And I also like what you said earlier about, like, you don't have to do thought leadership to, like, be successful, because by virtue of the term itself, like, it's only going to be, like, a few people that are going to be known as that, like, in their field.
Well, sometimes people are just loud.
And I think, like, we have all worked for quiet people. They're very successful. Like, they are getting jobs and losing jobs at the same rate as thought leaders. So I don't really know that there's, like, a huge benefit to it other than maybe some fame and attention and things like that. So, like, I wouldn't, like, I don't feel pressured to do anything major because the upkeep of it is so intense. Like, if you're thinking about a channel and, like, being popular on a channel, there's, like, a pace and a frequency and, like, you know, algorithm based, like, way that you need to behave, and all of that just, like, completely turns me off from it, right? Which is why I like this format a lot, and then, like, maybe just having, like, a personal blog or a Substack or whatever where you're not trying to monetize and you're just, like, you know, like, you're just kind of talking, like, appeals more to me. So I think there's also ways to do it. It's not a binary, you know, if you want to, like, dabble in it, like, there are some simpler things that you can do, like writing, you know, than like doing a big LinkedIn post. But, like, I think you bring up a really good point that, like, it's not really going to impact your career. You know, like, I think it actually might be easier to adversely impact a career than it might to, like, positively impact a career, would be my hypothesis. But I've also, like, hired thought leaders and, like, have, like, worked for thought leaders. And I don't know, man, it's a mixed bag. So
no, I think that's it. It's like, you can't de facto say very much about people who are, like, loud and vocal and thought leaders in their industry versus ones who aren't. Like, I think it's just, like, a lifestyle choice. There, we know so many great people out there who are great at their jobs. We've worked for them, we've worked with them. They're our industry peers, and they're very, very quiet on social media. They're not the ones who are always signing up to do panels and conferences and things like that. And we also know people who are very loud and vocal and known very well in their industry, and we know that they have no idea what they're talking about. And then every other combination of that, like, right, like, we've worked for and with terrible people who don't go on social media, and we've also we know people who are very loud and vocal who actually do know what they're doing. But so you're right, there's, like, actually very little overlap, and it's hard to say very much. But I think, like, the specific way that I can think of, I do know many examples, and I've also, like, sometimes made this mistake with hiring decisions, like, found people where, like, I kind of, like, have some level of name recognition of them, because, you know, you've seen them around the way, they're talking about things. And once they're actually on the job, it becomes more apparent that, like, they've devoted too much of their energy towards being vocal or, you know, saying these, like, interesting thought leadership things. And, like, then it's actually very difficult for them both to, like, actually succeed on the job and to do the job to the level that they were, because they've put all their career development energy into doing thought leadership stuff instead of, like, really cultivating craft.
Yeah.
Again, not always, but, like, some. And also because, like, often the amount of time and effort that it takes to go and do all of these, like, speaking gigs and like, all of these activities, like, in some cases can take away from, like, the ability to actually do the job.
Well, 100%. And I think it's, we're not trying to, like, uncle and auntie too much, but I am going to take a little uncle and auntie detour here, because it's a fair question to ask when you're hiring, I think, somebody who particularly, like, monetizes the stuff or has, like, sponsors or, like, is, you know, like, that kind of a thing, how they are going to balance that. I think that's a really fair question. And I think also, like, how, you know, I probably get a lot of flack for this, but I do think that the ego can be a problem. And I think it's, like, important. Look, we all have ego. I have ego. Like, there are ways in which, like, I have
ego.
Yeah. In check. Like, everyone has to keep it in check. But there are, I found specifically where it's hard is, like, for somebody who's a thought leader and monetizes it and is incredibly successful in doing that, or is a solopreneur and, like, has, you know, tens of thousands of followers on a newsletter or something, like, that's coming into a full-time job. They have not responded well if, like, when it comes to the annual review framework, right? And we start getting into ratings, like, that's where I've seen, like, quite a bit of that breakdown, because you know, executing on tactics and getting results versus, like, effort, energy, like, put in is already something that we all have to, like, recognize. Hey, you may have spent an entire quarter working on this thing, but it didn't have results. So that's, like, what I'm judging you on, or I'm being judged on, right? But yeah. It's a little different with I think, folks when it comes to, like, some thought leadership, because there is this other sort of sphere of contribution that does enter those conversations when it really has nothing to do with it. Like, it has no bearing on your performance. And
you mean, like, okay, you're having, like, a performance conversation with someone, and you're like, okay, I'm going to give you, like, an achieves expectations because, like, you performed in this way and, like, you worked on these things and it had this result. And they're like, well, but wait, what about all of my, like, industry thought leadership? What about my,
exactly, like, that,
what about the fact that I'm, like, representing the company in this way? Like, and you're right. Like, well, that's not about your performance review with this company.
It's not your role. So, like, yes, it doesn't really come into this. However, sometimes it can also, like, I've actually had someone say to me when I had given them some feedback that you need to work on your influencing skills, like, internally, right, with stakeholders, and making sure that there's, like, buy-in on a project or whatever. And they're, like, furious that I could possibly question influencing skills when they're somebody that commands, you know, the attention of tens of thousands of people on a newsletter on a weekly basis, right? And it's like,
yeah, you know, I understand. That's not the same influencing.
It's not the same kind of influencing that I'm talking about. And maybe the skill set is there, and what we need to talk about is how you apply that in this context, right? So I think you can get, like, I think just, like, always keeping in mind, especially as people diversify income streams and things like that, that, like, in a traditional job, like, you're going to be linearly, like, you know, like assessed, I guess, on the merits of that job. Yeah. And a lot of this other stuff is not really a part of the conversation. And that is a struggle, I think.
It is. And I mean, I even think about, like, you know, I'm turning the camera around on myself as well here, because as a person who has spent, what, the better part now of the last decade being, like, pretty loud and vocal about my industry and trying to, I don't know, produce content, insights, whatever you have, like, I'm acutely aware of the relationship of that between, like, between that and my job.
Mm.
And often I'm trying to draw a distinction where, like, I try not to bring too much of that into my day job and vice versa. I think it's helpful in the sense that when you're working out loud and you're vocal in the industry and you're making a lot of connections, like, those are people that you can learn from, you can turn to. Like, if your boss is like, hey, you need to go find, like, five people who do community really well because we need to solve this specific issue, or you need to like find someone who's doing this specific thing within digital. Great. Like, that's good, because now I have more of a network and I have connections that I can go talk to, and probably more people where, like, I have a little bit more social capital to leverage in that interaction. That makes it sound really transactional. Like, I promise sometimes these people are just my friends, but, like, that's where, that's, like, a positive intersection. I don't expect it to work the other way, where, like, just because I do podcasts and just because I wrote a book on customer education or something like that, that, like, that should bear on my, I don't expect more than, like, an achieves expectations, unless, like, there's something to be said about the results that I achieved with my team that, like, would really justify that.
Such a good point. Well, my friend, I think we have, we've kind of turned this topic inside out. Any final thoughts before we wrap it up? Been awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, we just have to remember what Lady Gaga warned us all about. The fame monster, even in our niche industries, can be a real thing, and chasing impressions and validation from randoms on LinkedIn is not always, like, what it's cracked up to be. So if you are feeling the pressure to be a thought leader because of your career, there are so many paths to do it. We're not saying don't take any of them, but, like, focus on what authentically you feel is worth sharing and like your earned insights, because like you might not feel like you're showing up the same way as like the thought leaders that you see on LinkedIn, but like I promise you that like that will feel a lot better in the end.
Yeah.
How about you, Dee?
I love that. I echo it. And I think also like, you know, if you're a voice that is not typically heard in a particular industry, that might be the one that I might say, okay, I actually try to do this. Like, you know, if you're older or younger, or you're from a marginalized group or what have you, like get in there.
Totally.
Because, you know, that's where I think I would be like thought lead more. And then, you know, I think what you said applies, like, it's about it being an authentic thing. Don't try to be somebody else, because chances are like what you have to offer is probably cooler, and it's gonna sound cooler coming directly from you. So
otherwise, like, we white dudes are just gonna start a podcast and say what you were gonna say anyway, so like you may as well do it.
Yeah, do it first. What do we want to have people talk to us about in our LinkedIn?
We'll post on LinkedIn and we will ask, I think, like what people like or dislike in thought leadership, like what they feel like makes really good, authentic thought leadership, because I'd love more positive examples.
Yeah.
Like, what do we really want to see?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, share some stuff that you like and some people that you find are doing it, quote unquote, right. I'd love to hear from you.
And in the meantime, you can always give us that 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you are listening to this podcast. And you can check out Alan Coda, as he's known in the music industry. Akoda. I actually don't know how he pronounces it. You're listening to his track right now, Ponzu Squib, from his new, I don't know why I'm promoting it, like his album is just out.
Thanks, Akoda.
I just like the guy. He's my friend. Okay. We'll see you around the way.
You trying to make that happen so bad. Around the way. Oh my god. Talk about old people talking. Like, you're hitting that.
Yeah, okay. I'm trying to make fetch happen.
There's this pizza brand called Bola Pizza that's like made here. And it's in the frozen section of
H. Say Ebola Pizza?
Bola Pizza, Bola. Well, okay, there goes that sponsorship. They're certainly listening to this podcast. It's this lovely sourdough crust with like awesome minimal toppings, but like just very well thought out.
I'm looking at them right now, and I am glad that their e-shop is not called Ebola Pizza. But yeah, it looks like it's just like an Austin brand, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's delish.
Applewood smoked mozzarella, caramelized onions. I think I would enjoy that.
There's like a Bollywood, which I have not seen. So that's new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That looks really interesting too.
I can't bring myself to
do it. I love Indian pizza.
I can't bring myself to do it. It's like too much of a leap for me.
Does it feel too like sellout-y, fusion-y?
No, not at all. I have absolutely
Or you just don't
no
like the idea?
Problem. I have like no problem with like that stuff. There's something about like the carb being so far from a rice with a tikka masala and then a cheese on it also like that like I'm dubious. I'm sure it's delicious.
Yeah.
But
it just like doesn't feel right.
Yeah, it feels like I dressed up for a casual hangout at someone's house and I got there and everybody's wearing like fancier clothing. I don't know. That's like a really bad way to describe it, but I feel like it's not, I don't know. I probably need to go to therapy about how I feel about this, because like I'm not really sure.